This is the MagicWordPodcast.com.
Hello, this is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com. Well, you can tell from that non-traditional intro music that we had that that's not our typical music that we use. And in fact, that means it's time again for another visit with author John Gaspard, because he has a new book out that is part of the Eli Marks Mystery Series, and this one's called The Linking Rings. This is a great book that is a lot of fun and a good read, and I recommend. Now, the reason that we're talking with John this week is because this book is not just one of your how-to instructional books about different card tricks, mentalism, or what have you like that. This more is specifically more of a mystery, something that is not just for magicians, but for mystery lovers. So don't think of this as necessarily buying this for you as a magician, although I know you'll absolutely love it because there are a lot of little in-jokes and stuff like that, kind of shop talk, but also because of some of the people, even who are characters in there that you can kind of relate to, saying, oh yeah, this guy reminds me of Jay Marshall or Paul Daniels or whomever. And you can kind of read that, how that some of these people were inspired. Well, John's going to talk about that. I don't want to get too far ahead of myself here with what he's going to talk about here in our chat. Well, this week, again, that as he has done in the past, he has offered to give us copies, that is, hard copies of the book. Unfortunately, that the Audible book will not be available until sometime in mid to late 2018, because they're still working on that. But the book itself will be available after mid-January of 2018. So he has offered three copies of the book, which we're going to be giving away. And in order to enter the contest, if you'll wait until the back end of this podcast, I'll give you the information on how that you can register to have a chance to win a copy of one of his books. And in this particular case, you don't have to take The Linking Rings, the newest book, if for some reason that you don't have one of the first three books that he's written and you'd like to start somewhere there or would like one of those. He'd be glad to send one of those which are already available, and he can get those right out to you straight away. This week's podcast is brought to you by the Friends of the Magic Word, and in particular, I want to welcome the newest member of the Magic Word, Mr. Hiram Norman. Thank you, Hiram. I certainly appreciate you joining the Friends of the Magic Word and for pledging your financial support via Patreon.com. And for the rest of you who might be interested in joining, please think of this as being kind of the end of the year in which you're looking for an opportunity to share goodwill. And what better way than to share with someone who has a similar passion as you. If you like podcasts like I do, and you like this podcast like I do, then you might consider joining the Friends of the Magic Word. And there's some really cool perks you can get along the way, too. If you go to patreon.com/themagicword, it'll give you information. Or if you go to themagicwordpodcast.com and click on the tab over there that says Become a Friend of the Magic Word, it'll give you information about that. Plus, I've got a short video kind of explaining why it is that we need to have your financial support, which is to help keep this podcast going from week to week. And let me also point out that the clip which we play partway into this was reading of the first chapter. It was really about 30 minutes long, and I've pared it down so you can kind of hear it fade out and then come back up. So I pared it down to about 10 minutes or so, but the clip itself is a little bit longer. And if you go to the website here at themagicwordpodcast.com, I do have a link where you can go to read the first chapter for free. John has graciously put that out on the internet, so this way that you can download and read that in a convenient ebook, whatever that you're reading, a Kindle ebook reader, a PDF, whatever that you'd like. So I'd recommend that you go and read that after you've listened to a little bit of this. You're actually not getting the full chapter. You're getting just about a third of it. So anyhow, I'm going to step out of the way, introduce our guest this week, because I know that you're going to love him. Oh, let me just also apologize, unfortunately, a little bit on the front end over here for the quality of the sound. We did this as a Skype call, and we had some problems on his end of the conversation of fading in and out, so I want to apologize for that. We tried to redo that a second and a third time, and each of those got progressively worse for some reason. I don't know why, and so this is the best we've got. So again, please stick with it. I know that you'll enjoy hearing the information that he has to share with us this week, so please welcome my guest, author John Gaspard, here on The Magic Word.
Thank you.
Hello, this is Scott Wells for the Magic Word Podcast.com, and it gives me great pleasure to always be right when something actually works the way that I thought it was going to, and it absolutely did. In this particular case, that I made a prediction some years ago, and you guys have been on this journey with me, so you can validate this, but basically, there was a book that was written that was about a fictional magician detective named Eli Marks. And at that time, the thought was and the plan was for this to be a long-running series. Well, it actually, I think, becomes a series when you've actually had three or more of these books. And the author had continued with this one book after the other and kept more than just plodding along, has actually had this long-range vision, and it actually has come to pass. And so we're now into the fourth book of the Eli Marks series. It's called The Linking Rings, and we're very pleased to have the author here today, Mr. John Gaspard. Hey there, John.
Hey, Scott. Good to be here.
Always great to have you, and I know how long it takes for books to be written, and I mean, you have to have the vision and the fact that, you know, this has continued to be an ongoing series. I mean, that you could be like the next Ian Fleming, you know?
I hope so.
Yes. I mean, with him writing, I don't know how many James Bond novels. So I'm going to say at least about 16 or 17 of them, right? And then he had successors after him, after he had died. You know, John Gardner had taken over as his successor, and he continued to write more books about James Bond. So hopefully you live many more years to write many more books, and that perhaps this might go into a successor that someone might want to continue on. Because I think the character itself has a lot of nuances and a deep character. So there are different things that you can write about, and the people who are in his life that you write about, I think, mm-hmm. seem to come to life, and that after you have read these, then you're anxious to see or to hear and read what the next one's going to be. And I say here because not only do you have these available in paperback book, but also, of course, through Books on Tape. Anyhow, I'm way ahead of myself. We're now into the fourth book of about Eli Marks. Tell us a little bit about kind of the journey, I guess, you know, and for those people who need to be caught up for the first three books and the titles of those, and because I think that's fascinating also as to how you choose the titles of the book. So, let me ask you kind of what has been that journey to leading up to where we are right now?
Okay, well, the first one, I wanted to write a mystery, and I realized I had a lot of friends were magicians. Which to this listening audience isn't that weird, but if you talk to the average person on the street and say, have you ever met a magician, most people will say no. And
right.
I seem to know more than my share for someone who wasn't really involved in magic. And I thought that would be a very fun character to follow, someone who is in his 30s, is recently divorced, is kind of getting restarted. He's moved back into his childhood home, which is the apartment above the magic store that his uncle owns, and he makes his living. Eli makes his living as a magician, and is admittedly a good magician, not a great magician. And I think one of the things people like about Eli is he's very aware of his shortcomings. He's not neurotically so, but his uncle Harry is a world class magician. He hangs out with world class magicians, and he's just a pretty good one who makes a pretty good living and happens to occasionally stumble into crimes. In the first one, The Ambitious Card, he debunks a psychic because his uncle can't be there to do it, because that's normally what his uncle does. And the next day, the psychic ends up dead, and he's got a bloody King of Diamonds in his pocket, the same one that Eli had given to him the night before after doing the Mellini knife stab. So at that point in The Ambitious Card, he's a suspect and has to clear himself. The second book is called The Bullet Catch, and in that one he goes to a high school reunion and ends up being involved kind of in two different plots that run concurrently. One, there's an old flame whose husband is mugged and killed on the night of the reunion, and the other is a buddy of his who's become a TV star and is now making a low-budget movie and has to do the bullet catch in that movie. And so Eli is helping him do that, and being that his friend is an actor and kind of paranoid, he's sure that he's going to be killed in the process because the actual shooting of the bullet catch scene is the very last scene you're shooting, and he knows that they'd get huge publicity if they actually killed him. Then in the third book, The Miser's Dream, It's sort of a locked room mystery. Eli's apartment overlooks the actual movie theater next door. Everything takes place in Minneapolis. Everything takes place on Chicago Avenue in Minneapolis. The store is called Chicago Magic, although it does not exist, but most of the other shops along that strip do. And right next to where the Magic store would be is a movie theater called the Parkway Theater. And from the third floor, you would be able to see the projection booth. And Eli looks in one night and sees the projections just lying dead on the floor. It's a locked room, locked from the inside, three very small holes that the projections uses to shoot the image out onto the theater screen, but no other way to get in. And Eli gets involved in how do you solve that mystery of how was someone killed in that room, shot in a room. Anyway, so each of the three stories is quite different in that respect because they're not exactly the same sort of cookie cutter thing. The fourth book, The Linking Rings, Eli goes to London with his uncle Harry, who's getting an award at the Magic Circle. And on stage that night, as the curtain opens, Harry's discovered standing there with a dead body next to him and becomes the key suspect in what becomes a series of murders of older magicians, all of whom were buddies when they were younger. And they're being knocked off one by one. And after some research, Eli comes to the conclusion that the only person who could be doing it was another magician friend of theirs at the time who has been dead for 40 years. And that uses a lot of kind of international characters. It's sort of like an Agatha Christie, and then there were nuns sort of structure for that one.
Right, right. Phenomenal. Yes, I think that you tipped a little bit kind of information on what to expect with that fourth book that's going to be coming out there then, too. By way of introduction into what the Linking Rings book is going to be about, I mentioned that this is not only going to be in hardback, or actually paperback form, but also is going to be available then as an audiobook as well. And so we have the person who is reading the book for the audiobook available right now, so I'm going to give you just a taste of what this is like by listening to the first chapter to kind of get you excited about getting your copy of the book pre-ordered here before Christmas. So let me introduce the reader right now. And who is it, by the way, who is reading this?
His name is Jim Cunningham, and I'll tell an interesting story about him after they listen to the clip.
All right, and here's the clip. So, ladies and gentlemen, Chapter 1 from The Linking Rings by John Gaspard.
The Linking Rings, an Eli Marks mystery. Written by John Gaspard. Read by Jim Cunningham. Chapter 1. There were many attractions I had hoped to see on my first visit to London. The inner workings of the city's jail system had not been one of them, especially on day one. When planning the trip, I had assumed my biggest concern would be jet lag. I was wrong. While it proved to be a real issue, it came in at a distant second to raising bail. At the moment, though, jet lag was all I had on my mind as I suppressed yet another yawn. Coming to the Magic Circle directly from the airport had been Harry's idea, because his plan was to spend as little time in London as possible. Consequently, all I had seen of the city so far had been the interior of Heathrow Airport, some blurry views of a rainy metropolis from within a careening cab, and now the second-floor meeting room of the venerable Magicians' Club, the Magic Circle, located somewhere in the mysterious heart of London.
"Every time you yawn, you make me yawn," Harry growled in a poor imitation of a stage whisper.
"I've noticed that," I said, doing a considerably better job of keeping my voice down. "It's kind of cool."
"Easy for you to say," he said. "You don't have to go on stage in 45 minutes.
That was true. My role for the evening's gala event was strictly that of an observer. Harry's responsibilities were far more substantial, and he leaned forward to listen closely to the instructions that were being given to him and the evening's other performer by the club's executive director. The room was beginning to fill with magicians, and Harry and his soon-to-be stage partner were at the top of that particular food chain. The reactions they were getting exemplified an odd phenomena I've experienced through a life spent observing my magician uncle. While in the presence of normal people, that is to say, non-magicians, Harry was looked upon as your run-of-the-mill, cranky and charming old man. But let him walk into a room full of magicians, and it's as if the Dalai Lama had just arrived. He was, as he liked to put it, an occasional rock star. Although at this moment, he was one of about a half dozen Dalai Lamas in the room. It was a virtual who's who of magicians of a certain age. But right now, my focus was on the two who were about to go on stage. He put one hand into his pocket and began to casually walk the stage. I'm particularly pleased to be able to introduce tonight's two performers, for we go way, way back. He exaggerated the final way and winked at the audience. Of course, I was just a mere lad when I met them, and they were already well into their dotage. This produced the laugh he intended, which he waved away with his free hand. No, no, I admit, tonight's performers are my contemporaries. I will own up to that. I'm a big enough man to admit that. In fact, I've even invited several of them, a few of whom are a step above street buskers and pickpockets, into my own home while they are here in London, he continued, making it sound like the grandest of gestures. Mind you, I've put away the good silver, he added quickly. I'm not a bloody idiot. More laughter and applause from the crowd, and I remembered I'm not a bloody idiot was a well-known catchphrase of Lawrence Baxter's when he'd been appearing on television regularly in his own long-running primetime show. Tonight's two special performers are each receiving a recognition which is long overdue. By order of the Society's president, each is being bestowed the Devant Award, named in honor of the first president of the Magic Circle. This produced a thunderous ovation, the volume of which was surprising because the auditorium probably only held 150 seats or so, including the small balcony above us. Lawrence Baxter smiled at the enthusiastic response and even placed the microphone under his arm so he could join in the applause. Once it had subsided, he took the microphone in both hands. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming two unparalleled performers as well as dear, dear friends, Oscar Korhonen and Harry Marks. Another deafening ovation as he stepped toward the wings. The curtain parted, revealing the two older performers. It was clear the two magicians had been positioned in a tableau, but it was also immediately apparent something had gone askew. Oscar was seated in a majestic, high-backed wooden chair, with Harry standing right next to him, in what I'm guessing had been intended as a regal pose for the pair. The applause rapidly slipped away, and a few people laughed, and then just as quickly stopped, realizing this was not intended to be a comic entrance. Somewhere in the auditorium, someone shrieked. Oscar was slumped over in the chair. Harry stood over him. He didn't look out at the audience. He wasn't dazed, but instead looked deeply puzzled. He was looking down at Oscar Korhonen, who had a large knife sticking out of his back.
So that's the first chapter. It ends with a bit of a cliffhanger there. What's interesting about the reader of this book is his name is Jim Cunningham. He's a local actor here in the Twin Cities. He's an announcer for the Wild hockey team. He does announcing for the Minnesota Twins. He has a long-running show at the Minnesota Renaissance Festival. And he's also a friend of mine for 30 years or so. And it's probably because of his interest in magic that I got interested in going down the Eli Marks path, because he's a part-time magician. He would not call himself professional magician, but he does a certain amount of magic. And he's the one who came to me after the first book was out and said, you know, we could do this as an audiobook. And it's so much fun sitting and recording these with him, because he's a very funny guy anyway, and he's absolutely nailed all the characters. And I often tell people, I think if you have the option between reading the book or listening to the book, I would listen to it, because he's so good at it. But what's particularly fun about The Linking Rings is there are so many old magicians in it. In the first chapter there, you met Oscar, who's Finnish, and then he's got to do Harry, and then he has to do a British kind of a Paul Daniels type. Mm-hmm. And then as the book continues, he has a Spanish magician, he has a Romanian magician, he has a German he has to deal with, he has a police inspector who has an Indian accent.
So he does all of these accents.
He does all of these accents, but he gets very frustrated by them because he wants them to be great. And if I kept in outtakes, more than once you'd hear him say, "Would you kill this guy now? Just kill him now." And I really did try to kill them in the order where I thought the most difficult ones were first, but I was wrong. Anyway, the audiobook won't be out at the same time as the other books, just because he does it in his spare time. Mm-hmm. And we hope to get it out sometime in later 2018. But it the books wouldn't exist at all if it weren't for Jim Cunningham. And another interesting sidelight from that is, because of Jim, I've now become a magic producer. In that, with Jim and our mutual friend Suzanne, the magician here in Minneapolis, we, the three of us, are now producing a monthly magic show for the public called Sunday Night Magic.
Right.
It's not always on the same Sunday night. Because of Suzanne's connections in the magic world, every month we get a big name magician who comes in and they do a lecture at Eagle Magic, Larry Kalo's place out in Burnsville. And then they do a show that night for the public. And we have a beautiful little theater that's given us the space. We can seat about 150 people. And we've had Derek Hughes was just here in November.
Wow.
Kind of a surprise guest. Derek lives here, and we all know Derek, so he just happened to be here for Thanksgiving.
Oh, I didn't know he was there. Okay.
I believe we hosted the last live performance Eugene Berger did in June, so we got to spend the weekend with him. David Parr has come in from Chicago a couple times. We just had Ken Scott. We've had Nathan Comarch. We just had a lot of great people. And it's really interesting to meet all these different folks. And that's how I learn so much. And I'm able to write in a way that a lot of people think the books are written by a magician, when in fact I know more than the average person and far less than the average magician. And I have people like you who have kindly looked at the books before they're published and said, no, John, this is how you do that. No, this is the wrong word. No. And so they feel correct from a technical level.
Yeah.
But also because I married an actress and I have friends who are actors and I have friends who are magicians, I kind of get the performer's mindset and what it's like to be a performer and what annoys you to be a performer and you know, where the red flags are for you. And so that's one of the reasons I think Eli works, is he seems like a real guy who really is doing, you know, forced into a kiddie show that he's not ready to do, or doing a corporate gig with a drunk audience. I mean, all that sort of stuff that all magicians know, I kind of know too from talking to magicians and dealing with performers. So anyway, that's just a long way of saying Jim Cunningham made the books possible, and it's just so much fun to listen to him read them.
Right. So does he actually confer with you as well to say, well, like you said, you should kill this guy off? Or do you go, you don't rewrite the book, I guess, after that's all finished and he's starting to do the reading of it, do you? Or do you consult with him beforehand?
I don't. No.
Okay.
No. By the time he gets to it, it's already
finished.
The publisher's already gone through it, and it is 99% finished. If we find a word or two wrong, then we'll fix them. And actually, Jim reads the books cold. So he has never read it when he stands in front of the microphone.
That's interesting. So he doesn't know what's going to be happening at the end either with any of the characters.
He doesn't know what's going to be happening. And he, you know, he's been a professional voice talent for 30 years. And so you put him in a sound booth, put a copy in front of him. You know, he's brilliant. He knows what he's doing. So there's not a lot of editing has to go on, but he will read through a paragraph and then go, oh, I see there's a joke there. Hang on. You know, go back and redo it.
Right.
But it's, you know, when he, when he launches into Uncle Harry, it's the same Uncle Harry in book four that it was in book one. Once he landed on who that was, he just gets it. And it's a great thrill for me just to sit there and listen to him read it aloud.
Right. It kind of makes your book come alive more, I'm sure.
It really does. Mm-hmm. It really does.
Well, you know, that's something I think that's amazing about reading books or listening to books is that you imagine this character of who it's going to be or what he's going to look like. But then once a movie gets made, you know, like about Harry Potter, for an example, that the person forever will be that actor. It will not be the person that someone had made up in their minds, you know. I mean, for an example, I think of Jack Reacher. Whenever I read those mm-hmm. books, I have a person in mind, and it's not Tom Cruise. You know, he has a completely different character and build and everything. And so when and if they ever make movies of this, I've got a picture of what this what Eli Marks kind of looks like, although you really haven't fleshed him out as far as a lot of his identifying features, physical features, I should say, as it is what he's going to be doing in certain situations. In a way, when I said Ian Fleming, same way like with James Bond, you know, there are a few features that Ian Fleming had fleshed out about him, but it was such that he could easily have been played and was played by about seven different characters, or rather actors, and they all really became James Bond. And I think that, and I refer back again to Jack Reacher, that I have a specific picture of what this guy is going to look like because the author talks a lot about his features. Anyhow, right. You know,
but it's interesting you say that because in the case of Eli Marks, because it's told in first person, he never describes himself.
Of course.
And we have no idea what he looks like, but in having spent, a day with Derek Hughes this last week, and I've known Derek as a performer. I mean, I've saw him back when he was, I don't know, 20 years old. I've seen Derek for years and years because he was a Minneapolis guy, and we had the pleasure of working on one project together. And we were chatting about Eli Marks because he is helping me sort of. There's people who want to shop it around in Hollywood, and I don't know what's going to happen there. And he's offered some advice in that area.
Right.
And I looked at him. And I said, Derek, you know, you are essentially Eli Marks.
I can see that.
Someone else might read the books and see something else, but he is, you know. Good magician who's very funny.
Yep.
Good looking guy, kind of mm-hmm. sardonic, a little sarcastic, but also mm-hmm. has a warm side to him. And I think he was sort of tickled by that. But that's sort of who I'm picturing when I write it is, you know, a Derek Hughes type.
Huh. Well, that's insightful. And, you know, I can kind of see that, certainly from his character and being, you know, seemed like a family guy and nice guy. And as you say, mm-hmm. funny and has charisma and, is comfortable in his skin, I guess, basically. You know, I could see him being a perfect actor for that part. And I could see how you'd, after reading the books, that is insightful. That's interesting. Well, you know, along that line, I think part of what makes Eli Marks come alive is that you put him in real situations, I should say, where there are real places, for an example, even though that this Chicago Magic Shop that does not exist, but it is in an area that does exist, and the street signs and everything else you talk about in the neighborhoods, et cetera, are all real places. In other words, that you drop a fictional character into a non-fictional place.
Right. Yeah, it helps. The next one that I'm working on right now, which is called The Floating Light Bulb, mostly takes place at the Mall of America, which is people might not necessarily know the ins and outs of it, but everybody knows the name. Oh, my God, Mall of America, it's huge. Got an amusement park in the middle.
Right.
So there's stuff in there that I'm taking that's real, but there's also a lot of stuff I'm changing just because it works better if I change it or I want to change it. And I mean, there in that particular story, there's a theater in the center of the amusement park, and they have a magic show that runs eight times a day. Now, there is a little theater. It used to be a little theater at the Mall of America that did run shows every day, but it wasn't a magic show. So it's just taking the reality and giving a little bit of a twist to fit my purposes.
Right, right. And also the characters, again, that are around there, you know, particularly as we're talking about the Linking Rings right now, are fictional characters. But I think I read them or I see them based upon a real character in real life. In other words, that you earlier had alluded to this character being like Paul Daniels It was no question. I mean, mm-hmm. when I was reading this, the guy had this big estate and people were coming in and staying over in his West Wing or whatever. And, you know, I mean, that was Paul Daniels. I mean, although it didn't have a lot of the nuances, it did have some of the lines and things. I could imagine him in that part. And it seemed like that you had written that around him.
He was very much sort of the analog of what I was thinking of that. Very popular, very cultured, very, very, very good magician who has, in the case of this story, just risen several steps ahead of everyone else he had started out with. He had achieved a success that no one else had achieved, which is sort of a friction point throughout the story.
Right. Yeah, and the fact, again, that you had woven in a real place, that is the Magic Circle, and you've taken Eli actually out of his Minneapolis surroundings and started to let him become more of an international traveler. Maybe not an international star like his Uncle Harry, who was obviously well-known. And also, we're given a lot more information about Harry's background, I think, here in the Linking Rings than mm-hmm. we've known previously. And I have even a newfound respect for his abilities, and he's not just, you know, some old guy who did some tricks and had a magic shop. I mean, it's like, hey, I didn't realize he was as well known and knew all these guys, and he was respected by these other venerated magicians internationally as well, and had come over. But the fact that you had, I was going to say, woven in a real place, again, the Magic Circle. Now, you told me that you had done some research actually going to the Circle and had spent some time there. You go to London from time to time.
Yeah, my wife and I go once a year and spend a week there. And for maybe the last 7 or 8 of those years, we've been there at a time when there was the Magic Circle Christmas show. And so we're sort of gotten pretty familiar with the public side of that building. And so I know the layout, and I sort of exaggerated the size of the stage a little bit. Mm-hmm. But everything else is pretty accurate to the space, not necessarily to the organization or how it's run.
Right.
But if you read the book and walked in there, you'd go, oh, yeah, there's a hotel right around the corner. And, oh, yeah, it is easier to get to from this station than that station. And,
right.
Yeah, those are cobblestones, and it is a bit tricky walking down that alley. And, yeah, all that stuff is accurate. But once you get through the doors, the personalities are the executive director I've never met. I don't think he's that mean. I don't think number of people have died on stage there, at least not physically. But yeah, we love going every year. It's just so great to see very wide range of talent on one stage. Because I'm in Minneapolis, you know, until I started doing this monthly magic show, it was really hard to see magic. So I could go to a convention and see a bunch of magic. There's more stuff on TV, but in order to get a sense of the world I'm writing about, it really helps to go see it. And that annual show for me was a big part of that, because I could just see of a wide variety of performance.
Right. Now, were they aware, or are they aware currently, that you were writing a book about or based upon the Magic Circle and murder that took place there?
They are not, because I don't really know them, and they don't really know me, although they sort of recognize us now when we get there, because it's been, I mean, there's sort of that, oh, it's the Americans. Yes, we're holding your tickets. Yes, here you go. but no, there's no connection there at all.
Okay. Well, I'm anxious to hear kind of what their perspective is after they've had a chance then to read the book and see how they're our club, since I'm a member there. Our club is actually portrayed. And so, yeah, I've been there several times as well. Even though I reside in the U.S., I try to get there whenever I can. If I'm anywhere in the general area, I'll go out of my way. And so, yeah, it is really a great place. Well, another thing that I had mentioned a moment ago was about the names of the books, that you had from the very start the idea that you wanted to have the titles of these books named after specific tricks. And how did you go about it? I mean, is this something that do you start with a title and then you kind of work the book around it, or vice versa?
It's a little of both. In the case of The Ambitious Card, that was the first one, and that just struck me as being such a fun collection of words, an ambitious card. And I thought that would be the one, and then learned about the trick. Actually, that's sort of when I met Suzanne the magician. Was she became my teacher, and she taught me how to do the ambitious card. And I had this idea that, oh, okay, what I'll do is each one of the books will be named after a card trick, and then I'll learn the trick so I can do it when the book comes out. Unfortunately, the second one that I came up with was the bullet catch. And I liked the story so much, but I thought, well, there's no way I'm going to learn to do the bullet catch.
Right, right.
So I sort of abandoned that at that point. And I always try to find a link between the title and what's going on in the story. It isn't just named the bullet catch because it's bullet catching it. There's also other reasons why. The third book was The Miser's Dream, and that was sort of a late change. And this is because of our digital age now. The original title for that book was going to be The Trick That Cannot Be Explained. Mm-hmm. And I just love that whole jazz magic thing. I thought it was very interesting, and ran it by the publisher. And she said, we can't do that. That's too the title's too long. I can't tweet that title.
Oh.
There'll be nothing left.
Yeah, good point.
So
interesting.
So since he did A Miser's Dream in the book anyway, I just sort of rejiggered that. Made that my stream. Linking Rings has been one that I've had sitting there forever, just because I think he's mentioned it earlier. Eli doesn't like the Linking Rings. He thinks it's a stupid trick. And I wanted to bring that out. It didn't come out as much as I wanted in the book, but he and Harry have a discussion about, you know, it's only as good a trick as it's the way it's performed. I mean, you see it done right, you know, it is a great trick. And then I was able to do lots of little plays with rings in that book.
Right.
So yeah, there's always some sort of connection. It isn't just an arbitrary thing. Next, called the floating light bulb.
The floating light bulb. You know, you may already have this in mind, but another great title I think would be perfect. It would be The Professor's Nightmare.
Yes. Yeah. And actually, that gets performed. At the beginning of the floating light bulb. Yeah, that's the thing, and that's what attracted me to this whole project from the beginning was, originally I had both titles and moves as possible, you know, a trick name or a move, because I thought, like, the Balducci Force just sounded like a just sound like book titles. But then then I realized, because I go to great lengths to get the tricks right in the book, but also never really let the audience reader know how it's done, that as soon as I start introducing moves, it's like, well, if you're going to introduce a move as a title, then you have to explain it, and you can't explain a move in a, I mean,
right,
and you're just giving stuff away.
Correct.
So I've limited it to just the title, but there's no shortage. I've got bunch more planned, so that's the easy part is and then just finding the mystery that somehow ties them together is usually the challenging thing, which is why it takes so long to write them.
Right. No, I would think so as well. And whenever you do write them, do you have then, John, kind of an outline that is that this is the direction that I want it to go, and you start then fleshing that out and then say, okay, well, I can add this or whatever? But I mean, what is your writing process, I guess, for those who might
be interested? Well, now that I'm on the fifth one, I've sort of figured out my process, which is that I do an outline that covers about the first two thirds of the book and the very ending. So I know how it's going to end.
Yeah.
And the outline is detailed at the beginning, and it gets less and less detailed as it goes along, because I found that about the last third, I need to leave a lot of wiggle room there, because I'm going to come up with stuff that I didn't realize as I'm writing. So I know how it starts. I know what the thrust is, and I generally know who's killed and in what order. There have been instances where people who were supposed to be killed survive, because I went, oh, I'd be dumb to kill them. I can use them later. Or you just like them. You don't want to get rid of them. And then, yeah, so then I just sit down and start writing, and it's worked out pretty much that way, that I know the first two thirds. I know where I'm going to get to, and that last third grows out of what the first two thirds become.
Well, aside from Eli Marks, is there a character that you have fallen in love with? I mean, like, I love this person or this character. I like playing with them and writing about this character.
The relationship between Eli and his Uncle Harry is the most fun to write, because you have someone who who is a real expert in his field, who is very sage and wise, but also a caustic and cranky. Mm-hmm. And then you have this sort of glib younger guy who doesn't have the same chops. And so their arguments are always very interesting. I also like the dynamic between Eli and his ex-wife, Deirdre, who's a assistant DA. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the few, I don't know what the word is. To have him be divorced from someone in law enforcement was my way of getting him closer to crimes and closer to information when he's involved in crimes.
And for her to be married to a detective also, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, she's married to a homicide detective. So dealing with the two characters who are, you know, were married and are now divorced and who know each other really well, and there's still a friction there. And then the best one to write for, and I've only done it in two of the books, is a character who calls himself Mr. Lime.
After oh,
Harry
yeah.
Lime.
Yes.
Who is a very old, very charming, very...
Mysterious.
Very mysterious, kind of a criminal, although you mm-hmm. never really know right. what he's involved in, but who is taken by Eli's magic and has used him a couple times to help him or to help Eli. It's gone both ways. And he's a I had no idea how much fun he was going to be to write because he loves old movies and he's very enigmatic. But he also, as Eli says at one point, there is no better audience in the world for a magic trick than Mr. Lime because he when it's great, he just loves it, which is why in the Miser's Dream, when Eli tries to copy a version of the Miser's Dream he'd just seen the night before, and it sort of fails in front of Mr. Lime, that's the worst failure he can have because not only does his best audience not like it, but his best audience is a homicidal maniac. So what do you do then?
Yeah, yeah. No, I can see that.
And
that
then the other
that's a very interesting character
that's been fun to write that I brought back is a guy named Jake North, who was in The Bullet Catch. He's an actor in The Bullet Catch. He's Eli's old high school chum, has now become a pretty big deal actor. And because he did a movie about The Bullet Catch and because he had to pretend to be a magician, he now thinks he is a magician. And he makes kind of a surprise appearance in The Linking Rings because Eli finds out that Jake has stolen one of Eli's routines and is not only performing it without attribution, but has actually published it as his own. Mm-hmm. And I have to say, Scott, that I got a lot of great background for the feelings all the magicians, the various magicians in the story have to what's happening to Eli from the series you did a couple years ago about where there was an issue of...
with Gregory Wilson, yeah.
Yeah, right. Appropriation of who's taking what and what, you know. And that was just a treasure trove of magicians talking about their feelings about that, which was a huge help in writing those segments of The Linking Rings.
Yeah, well, thank you. Thank you very much on that. You know, and speaking of that, as I mentioned, the fellow who is the detective that is married to Eli Mark's ex-wife, I think is that dynamic is really interesting also, the way that they kind of have that friction between the two of them.
Yeah, it is fun because there's a natural animosity. You know, it's your ex-wife's new husband, and they'd had an affair while you two were married, and you shouldn't like the guy, and he's also not all that likable. But his name's Homicide Detective Fred Hutton, and Eli calls him that all the time. He uses the full name and title. He never refers to him by just a singular name. He has saved Eli's life on more than one occasion, and Eli has helped him enormously solve cases. So it's a weird sort of dynamic of they don't really like each other, but there's a mutual whatever.
Right.
Yeah, it's fun, right? And he's such a stoic, you know, monosyllabic character anyway. It's always interesting to bring him on screen.
There was a TV series called Father Brown, in which that Father Brown is mm-hmm. a detective also, as well as being a priest, and he's working with the inspector, and the inspector does not like to have
Father Brown help him, although he has to admit from time to time, obviously, that he helps him every week in solving these crimes. There's kind of I could say a similar kind of a thing over there. You know, going back to the characters there again, and keeping on track for a moment with the Linking Rings, I did want to circle back again there to talk about, again, Paul Daniels. But not only that, there were several other characters and some people you mentioned. I was thinking, for an example, you mentioned the Finnish magician Oscar, and I was wondering if some of these other characters may have been based upon some real-life people, maybe who you may not know as well personally, but might have been inspired by or heard of or something. And I was thinking, you know, that could have been, you know, maybe Finn John, or perhaps that this other couple in particular, they were kind of funny, that came into the play. And that would be Johnny Thompson and Pam, because they were great magicians, are great magicians, and kind of have a funny banter back and forth. And so can you tell us who these characters may have been based on? Or?
Sure. Well, you're absolutely right about Roy and Roxanne Templeton. Definitely have a Johnny and Pam kind of vibe to them. But I'm blanking on the name, but there's also another couple in Las Vegas. And he has his own show. He was at Genie a couple of years ago. Of a juggler, magician.
Oh, Charlie Fry?
Charlie Fry, yeah.
Yeah.
The relationship with his wife is kind of similar too. So it's sort of an amalgamation of all of them. And then if Charlie Callis were still alive, it's sort of all that. The one-armed Finnish magician,
Rene Levon,
a little bit of that, and then really, and I know this is a terrible reason to put something in a book. I just wanted to hear Jim Cunningham's reaction when we started reading and thought he had to do a Finnish accent. Actually, Oscar only has like two lines in the book, but I thought, well, this will freak him out quite a bit because he's got to do a Finnish accent. And I actually had prepared some samples for him. I went online and found some samples for him for that. There's Hector is a Spanish magician, and he's sort of just in the mode of – there's a lot of guys, you know, larger Spanish magicians. So he's definitely that way. And then there's a Romanian mentalist who's sort of – if Max Maven were Romanian, that's kind of where that came from.
Okay.
Yeah, just to make him a bit more foreign seeming, but he's definitely in that spooky mold.
Okay.
And then there's a sort of a working class magician, British magician, who's sort of a John Archer type in my mind.
Yeah.
Although I made this guy Scottish, and I don't think John Archer's Scottish. But it's just a weird sort of – it's like Agatha Christie used to do, where he had all these different nationalities.
Right.
And they're brought to this manor home, and they start dying.
Yeah, I like that concept about that, as you say, and then there were none. You know, at first I was thinking they're all together, and it was going to be like a Murder on the Orient Express kind of a thing. It's like, no, you know, then it was, yeah, then there were none kind of a thing. It was, it sounds like you're kind of also taking some basic mystery plots, like the locked room type of thing, which are always fascinating and can go in any direction. It's kind of, I guess what I'm saying is that you're using some basic plot premises that, just like magicians would use some basic methods, in other words, I say the methods, premises, I guess, like production, a vanish, a transposition, levitation, or whatever.
Right.
In other words, that you're using this, but you're doing it so completely different. And so, you know, the same thing here, that you are using like the locked room type of an idea as you had in a previous book or something, that there are so many other kinds of plots that you can go to and use in future books. I mean, I'm excited about where you're going. It's not every book is going to be a locked room kind of a thing, or, you know, right, or whatever. So there are a lot of plots certainly that you can use, and that they're brilliant. I think they're well written. I know when you had sent the copy to me for review and just kind of for some ideas and tweaking, it said version 5. So how many versions, I mean, and rewrites do you do?
It's really hard to say. because I don't really change version numbers that much. I just sometimes will resave it as a different version number just in case something goes wrong somewhere. But the process, which isn't really all that interesting, is that, and I write the outline, and it's in a Word document, and I have the outline, and then I just start at the beginning and start writing, and I just keep filling the outline. And so it's always the outline. The outline is always ahead of me.
Right.
As I move down, down the pages. And then I just keep resaving as different numbers, just to, you know, if I feel like I have a big chunk and I thought, well, if something were to go wrong, if the file were to be corrupted somehow,
right,
I might as well go ahead and save it. So I have no idea how many, there really aren't that many versions. It's just getting all the way to the end and then going back and rewriting and tweaking and tweaking and tweaking. And yeah.
Yeah. No,
it takes a long time.
I know that, but what you were saying earlier also, that you are starting to refine that time. You know, I look at some of these authors who just seem to pump out something every 6 months or so. And for the most part, most of them are really good, and they've gotten to be, you know, very popular. And I think the reason they're doing that is because they've got the process down. They know what to do and how to do it. And you're refining this, too, as you're saying that now you're going working on your fifth book, and that it should be coming out sooner. I'm sure the first book was something that you were grinding over and just took forever by comparison.
Well, for the first book, I had to learn to write like a magician. And also, that book had a lot of different psychics in it. And all the psychics in it who are killed in a way that reflects their area of psychic ability or proposed psychic ability. So that took a whole lot of research. And then as you get into each one, I just need to learn, you know, I had to learn more about the bullet catch. I had to learn more about the Miser's dream, just so I'm using them properly throughout it. And then I'm also trying to keep the structure different. I mean, I know that there's going to be a murder within the first 5,000-7,000 words. Something's got to happen there. And then, you know, you just get a sense of the rhythm of it. And, but other than that, I'm trying not to make it a formula where it isn't, you know, the same thing happening. You know, Eli wakes up every morning and there's a phone call and a murder.
Right.
So.
Yeah, that's true. You don't want to be formulaic, and I can see that certainly in all of these books, that they are completely different. I was talking with John Gardner, and you know that John Gardner was the successor to Ian Fleming, and he was a magician and a mentalist, actually, and I got to be friends with him and chatted with him, and he had said that there were probably no other books he could write about James Bond, because his character had been fleshed out and such that when he would, as you say, wake up in the morning, you know, the phone's going to ring. There was no situation he could be put in that the reader wouldn't know how he was going to get out of it, because they knew his character so well. And so that's one of the things, again, that you're with Eli Marks, it's not formulaic in that you know what's going to be happening at this point. But then again, we're still learning more and more about what he's going to be. And so after you've written about the 17th or 18th book, perhaps we will know what how he will react in certain situations.
I'll be a very old man by then.
Well, that's why I said at the beginning of the podcast, perhaps you might have a successor, someone that you're going to say, okay, you can have Eli from here on out. You know, I've already made my millions, and it's your turn from here on out then, too.
Millions part is a long way off.
Yeah. And so there is no end as far as what you see right now that Eli Marks is going to continue.
I've got plans that keep me busy for the next few years. So yeah, there's lots of stuff brewing with him.
That's great. Yeah. And again, the fact that, like with this book, that you have unfettered his feet, so this way he can fly and travel wherever in the world. I mean, that kind of opens up the world as his oyster, I guess, so that he can go wherever if he happens to, you know, I mean, for example, he hasn't been to Las Vegas, I don't think, yet in any of the previous books. So that might be some place that'd be another place to explore, certainly.
Yeah, I'm looking at that. He's talked about having been there when he was younger, but we've never seen him in the present day.
Right.
Certainly he'll end up at the Magic Castle, but since I've never been, I don't want to touch that yet. I know he's going to go on a cruise ship at some point. And there's a couple other things I'm playing with. So yeah, he's got lots to do yet. He's not done.
Yeah. No, I like the fact also that he is a vulnerable person or character. That is that he's not a megastar. He's a good average magician and plodding along and, you know, making a living and doing fine. He's got a magic shop and et cetera. You know, this is something that is plugged into current times, just because, again, you're talking about the digital age and they're using mobile phones, et cetera, et cetera. One of the things is, since he does own a magic shop, that you haven't really touched on yet, and that is just the plight of the brick and mortar magic shops. You know, there may be days in which that there may only be one or two customers who will be coming into the shop, I suspect. Is that something that you're going to touch on at all or maybe delve into?
Well, you might have a little psychic ability yourself, because that's a big part of floating light bulb.
Okay, then. We'll kind of leave it at that.
Yeah.
Without having to – okay. Interesting. So that's good.
Yeah. No, and it's a huge thing, because there aren't that many magic stores around, and I couldn't keep it running the way it was running without acknowledging the fact that I think Eli says in one of the books that he and Harry have realized more than one occasion they forgot to unlock the front door in the morning, and it never occurred to them because they're so used to nobody coming in. And that sort of comes to a head in the next one.
Right. Okay.
The floating light bulb, which is a ways off.
Yeah. Yeah. Interesting. Well, yeah. So this is going to be released in January. You want to talk about the date and how people can order or pre-order and what's happening?
Sure. You can pre-order it. The paperback or the ebook or the hardcover on Amazon or Apple or Barnes & Noble or Kobo, wherever you like to go. Pre-order is up and ready. It is be released on January 16th. We will have a book release party for anyone in the Twin Cities area on Saturday, January 20th at a little store called Once Upon a Crime Bookstore, who've been nice enough to host the last three launches as well. I always have a magician perform during launch, and I'm really excited that one of the guys I met at Sunday Night Magic, a young magician named Noah Sony, has offered to thrill and delight us. So that's Saturday, January 20th from noon to 2 at Once Upon a Crime Bookstore in Minneapolis. And if your listeners are interested, Scott, I will send you a link. If they just want to dip their toes into Eli Marks, there's an Eli Marks short story that I give out for free called The Invisible Assistant that is a good introduction to Eli and his world, and has another little kind of locked room mystery sort of thing where it's a murder-suicide, and the police think one person killed the other one, and Eli thinks it's the reverse of what they're thinking. So I can give you a link for that, and they can click on that and get their own copy of that for free.
Okay. Yeah, and I will suggest that those who are listening, by the way, that, of course, this is being recorded in 2017. I know that people listen to this in the archives. And we're talking about 2018, whenever this is going to be released.
Right.
And also that as far as the link goes, I've read the book. What is it, about 65 pages or something? I think it is fairly short. And it is in a PDF form. And if you just go to themagicwordpodcast.com, there'll be a link there. So this way that it will allow you to go and access this this free book that he's offering. So
yeah, the service, once you click it, it'll say, do you want it on a Nook or do you want it on a Kindle? Do you want it? It takes care of everything for you. It's really nice.
Okay. So it's not just a PDF you're going to be receiving.
It can be a PDF if you want. I think it gives you that option. It's set up so that for those of us who are digitally challenged, it's a nice service called BookFunnel, and they create all the different formats so that the reader can just go, oh, I read on a Nook, I prefer this.
Right.
I read on a Kobo, I prefer this. And you just click it and it's downloaded, and it's so easy.
Have you ever gone out on a book tour? Has the publisher asked you to do that yet?
They have not, and it's unlikely they would. I work with a very small publisher. They have about 20 authors, and they do a lot of great mysteries, a lot of really wonderful books. But the publishing world has changed so much that unless you have a big publishing house behind you, it's, you know, for example, Neil Patrick Harris has a children's magic book coming out soon. I would imagine that publisher will send him on a publishing tour.
Yeah.
For a small independent publisher, and this one's just right out of Dallas, Texas, there's just the margins are so thin they can't do that. So everything's just done online. They do what are called online tours, and you do live Facebook feeds, and you do blog interviews and that sort of thing. And I certainly have done a lot of bookstores here in town, but it's, and unless you've got a much bigger selling book, there's just, you can't make the economics of it work.
Well, whenever that you're traveling,
it's fun.
Yeah, I think it'd be fantastic and a lot of fun for you. Whenever you are traveling on personal business, do you ever try to arrange, I mean, like, let's say Dallas that's handling the publishing of this. If you're going to be going and visiting the publisher, would you ever think about trying to go to some of the local bookstores in Dallas and setting up some readings or discussions and Q&As?
Well, that's an excellent question, because in my real life, I'm a corporate video producer, and I do travel around shooting videos in different cities. The problem is that the scheduling on for a book signing or that sort of thing in a bookstore is fairly long. You got to get in there and say, I'm going to be here in 2 months, and they pick a date. Whereas for video production, it's, can you get on a plane? Cause I need you in
now.
Austin on
yeah.
tomorrow. So it never really connects that way. Just
okay.
Too bad.
Yeah. No, I didn't know how that you might have plans like that, but yep, I certainly understand that. So that makes sense. Well, listen, it sounds fantastic, and I'm excited about the next new book, the fourth new book coming out over here, and I think that would be an excellent holiday gift to be giving yourself or to a loved one, perhaps, if you have a magician friend.
It's not just for
magicians. Yeah,
it's not
good
just
point.
For magicians. Anyone, in fact, when the first book came out, the publisher said, this will be great for, you'll have a great audience, built-in audience with magicians, and I said, that's not true. If you're a magician who likes mysteries, absolutely. In fact, if I can just tell one very brief Eugene
sure.
Berger story, because I really only have one Eugene Berger story now. I got to pick him up at the airport when he came here to perform, and everything people said about it was absolutely true. There was just a quality to him as a person that was so interesting, and he connected so quickly and so personally. And I dropped him at the hotel, and then he wanted to rest for a while, and I went to pick him up for dinner, and we walked down to the lobby, and he said, did you bring a deck of cards? And I said, I don't know quite how to say this, Gene, but I'm not a magician. He said, but your emails all have these books. Aren't those educational books? And I said, no, those are the titles of novels. That are mysteries about a magician. And he said, oh, that's very interesting. Do they sell well? And I said, they do okay. They don't necessarily sell strictly to magicians. And he said, well, that's because they don't read. Well, that's clearly a bugaboo with him.
Yes.
The fact that he's unhappy that magicians don't read about magic, and it just applies to everything. And I said, well, that's not entirely true. There's a lot of magicians who love the books. But they are not just for magicians. Regular people, really more of the primary audience, and that subset of magicians who like mysteries, I think will enjoy them. But if you're a magician and you don't like mysteries, you're not going to like this book, I can guarantee it. You may enjoy it, but it's the mystery reader is the audience I was going after.
Right. That's what I was about to say, that the mystery reader, it doesn't matter whether they're a magician or a juggler or a tightwire walker or just, a house painter or whatever, it just happens to be a magician. So yeah, it's more about the journey, and because you're not explaining anything. It's not a textbook. It's not an educational book that's saying, here's how you do a double lift or whatever, at all. I mean, you're right. This is,
I would say that Penn reveals more on Penn and Teller Fool Us than I do in the books.
Yeah. Well, and that again, kind of coming full circle, is the reason that I really wanted to talk with you, and I do talk with you each time that these books come out, is because there are magic books that come out all the time, and I really don't talk much or at all with the authors of those kinds of books that are just new books coming out to teach us some new tricks or whatever, because again, they're coming out every week or so. Well, the books don't come out as often as they used to, because as Eugene said, magicians aren't readers. But the fact that this is a book that is about a magician who also does some sleuthing. You know, basically, it's a mystery book. You know, I had recently spoke with Sarah Skilton, who is an author, and talking about a mystery book that she had written. It had nothing to do about teaching tricks, but all about this mystery. So I find this fascinating. There are so few books that that are about magic and magicians that put us in a good light, I should say. Number one, it's we're not like the evil person who ends up being the one who was the killer. And number two, they're not a Harry Potter fantasy type of a person. And I know that going back to the very first one, that you have kept true to that from the standpoint that I remember when we spoke in, I think, the first chat about the first book, The Ambitious Card, where that your publisher was saying, well, why couldn't they just get out by waving a wand and they could escape? Well, that's not what a real magician in today, you know, would be. And so that would be a completely different character and not what you wanted to do. So you're keeping true to the fact of what a real magician is.
Yeah, I didn't want it to be like Now You See Me, those films where the magic right. is not real, where it's not at all practical. I didn't want it to be, although I love Bill Bixby as the magician, there's a lot of stuff in that series where it isn't what a real magician would do in that situation, given the tools that she or he may have at hand. Mm-hmm. And that's always been the premise was Eli deals with the situation based on what he has in his pockets. And he has nothing in his pockets and he uses his wits. But he doesn't do anything that couldn't physically happen.
Right. Right. I like that.
Cause I hate that. I hate that in when they make magic be, it can do anything.
Yeah. I like that you keep true to just, the reality of what the magician is. So that's great. I agree. I kind of hate that too. It's a whole different genre, you know, books, I guess, when it gets into fantasy.
Yeah.
Well, John, thank you again very much for spending the time with us and telling us about the new book. And I'm excited to see this. And I know that all of the listeners are interested as well. Now, I've asked you about your magic word, and of course, you know, you are a friend of the magic word, and I appreciate you being a supporter then as well. And so let me ask you, what is your magic word today? I know it changes from time to time, but what's your phrase? What's important?
I don't know. Lately, it's been collusion, but that's just because it's been in the news. My magic word. You know, it really does come down to persistence. Is for me the willingness to just put your head down and do it. Has anything I've gotten done that was any good was because I just ignored the fact that it was going to be a long, hard struggle. I mean, when I put together the new outline for the new book, it starts with one sentence, and that's it. It's a blank page, and before I know it, it's 200 pages. And that doesn't happen without just going, all right, this isn't always going to be fun. I just need to be persistent.
Yeah. Good point. Persistence. I like that because, yeah, nothing worth doing is going to be very easy. You have to have a little blood, sweat, and tears and some time to take. And so,
yep.
The fruits of your labor are coming about. Well, listen, thank you again very much, and I appreciate it. And so, for the Magic Word Podcast, that was John Gaspard, and this is Scotty out.
It's so much fun to hear you say that.
I want to thank John Gaspard for being my guest today and for telling us about his new book. I hope you have a chance to go to Amazon.com and pre-order your copy today. Or if you're listening to this after it's already been released, then go ahead and order yours right off the website as soon as you can. I know that you'll enjoy it. Again, he's got various ways of getting this, and that is whether it's going to be a hard copy, that should say a paperback hard copy, or whether that you want to have an ebook of some type. Now, I mentioned at the beginning of this podcast that we were going to be giving away three copies of this book. And if you'll go to themagicwordpodcast.com, there you will see a registration form. And if you'll just fill it out with your first, last name and your email address, we will enter you into the contest and be able to ship this out to you wherever you are. So I want to thank John again for offering these books to the listeners, and I know that you're going to enjoy it. And one of the things that he also has offered is not necessarily just this one book. That is that if you prefer to start at the beginning and get The Ambitious Card, or if you want The Miser's Dream, or if you want to get The Bullet Catch, then that's fine too. Just ask for any one of those three books or the one that is the newest one, The Linking Rings, and he'll be glad to send that out to you. I mentioned that there are three books that will be given away, compliments of John. Two of these will go to random listeners, as we have just used the randomizer and it'll be selected from the spreadsheet. And the third book is going to be given to one of the Friends of the Magic Word. That is kind of a little perk we'll give to those who are members of the Friends of the Magic Word. So it's a little bit smaller pool. And if you're interested in increasing your chances, then I suggest, if you would, to provide us with either a one-time donation or an ongoing pledge through patreon.com, and that way you can become a Friend of the Magic Word. And again, you can participate in these contests as well, and maybe have an opportunity to get one of these books a little bit better chance, since, again, it's a little bit smaller pool than just the 10,000 plus listeners that we've got who are out there. And I thank each and every one of you, by the way, for listening to the podcast week after week. And I also thank Friends of the Magic Word. And in particular, as I mentioned before, I want to welcome Hiram Norman, who is the most recent Friend of the Magic Word. And if you want to join him along with others, go to themagicwordpodcast.com and you'll see a tab there where you can become a friend, and please help and support us. One last thing, and that is that I know that it's the holiday season and you're going to be buying things for yourself and your loved ones. And a lot of times you're going to be purchasing things on Amazon. Let me suggest, if you will, please, to go through the link that's provided here on the podcast. If you do that, then through our affiliate program, Amazon helps support the Magic Word podcast. So this is an indirect way in which that you don't have to necessarily give a donation. If you're going to be going and buying something from Amazon, then we will receive something from them through their affiliate program. And I want to thank you very much for doing that. Again, if you'll go to themagicwordpodcast.com, you'll see a tab there where that you can click on that, and you can then go to the Amazon page, and by using that, it tracks the link so that way that it knows it comes back to us. Anyhow, enough of that. So I thank you guys again very much for listening. And so until next week, stay well, get booked, and be persistent. This is Scotty out.